On this week's 51%, we look back on some of our favorite conversations from 2024. Youth mentor Chelsea Gooden teaches us how to empower the teenage girls in our lives. And former NOW President Patricia Ireland reflects on the early years of her career, fighting for better working conditions as a flight attendant for Pan Am.
I used to joke and say that it was good training for being in the feminist movement and in Washington, D.C., because part of what I did was pick up people's garbage and thank them for it.
I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Happy New Year, and thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. This week, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from 2024. There was a lot to pick from, and it was a pretty heavy year, but we tried to stay a little on the lighter side this time, focusing on interviews we felt were particularly fun, or different, or helpful. First up, Chelsea Gooden, a public speaker, academic tutor, and youth mentor who has dedicated her career to working with teenage girls. Gooden believes that teenage girls are some of the most blunt, smart, thoughtful, speaking truth to power people on the planet, and the key to having more empowered women in the world is to support girls through their tough coming-of-age years. Too often, she says, girls are stripped of their confidence by the time they grow up. So she compiled all of her tips for parents, teachers, and other youth mentors in a new book called Underestimated, The Wisdom and Power of Teenage Girls.
A girl has an innate ability to kind of see through things, and she still has a fearlessness herself about saying these things. What happens, though, is so often we, as a society, squash that voice and try to put her into this container of perfectionism and people-pleasing and making sure everyone around her is happy and that she's likable. And that's when that force is what I see isn't reaching its powerful potential.
How do you have these conversations with teens, and how do you help your daughter with things like people pleasing without accidentally passing down some of your own bad habits?
Well, often when they are sharing big feelings, what adults often do is we try to quickly fix it or advise or slap positivity on it, because it's hard to see a girl maybe in pain sharing more uncomfortable feelings. And instead, what I've learned is actually holding space for those feelings, just listening. Girls do not feel like they are listened to. And then afterwards being like, yeah, that sucks. Like, that does sound frustrating or disappointing, using the exact words she used. And I always phrase everything as a question. So that's probably my number one tip, is phrase everything with a question that has genuine curiosity without a secret agenda behind it and a non-judgmental tone. And a girl can sniff out a tone of judgment. She can sniff out an agenda, and she really wants to know that you are just meeting her where you're at, where she's at, and want to know what's going on in her world. And so often those questions that I phrase, it could be something along the lines of, instead of after she shares something difficult with me and I give my advice on how to fix it, instead I say, what do you think the solution is? And she honestly comes up with better ideas than I come up with. And then I affirm her, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what a good idea. That was smart. And then she hears that and is like, wait, you know, my idea is smart, and can own her own way forward in a lot of these struggles that she might have. Or I will ask, what are your thoughts on that? Or how did that make you feel? Or how would you like to handle this? Things that really denote respect for her thoughts on the issue.
One of the biggest things that I think we tend to inadvertently pass down to our daughters is just like certain ideas about beauty standards and body image. And that's something that they're already going to get bombarded with by society and social media anyway. So it's not like we can shield them from that exactly. But, you know, how can we help girls feel more confident in their own skin?
Yeah. So a girl's relationship to beauty and her body is so important. And, you know, eating disorders, disordered eating is very rampant. So we need to take it super seriously. And at the same time, hold space for a girl to explore her sense of identity. And it's not wrong for a girl to want to explore makeup or her outfit and fashion. And so how can we keep positivity around that while still being aware of damaging narratives, right? So I will say, I find this starts on a very simple level on how, you know, the one thing we can control is what we talk about and what we talk about in a home environment. And girls have told me over and over again that the women in their lives are constantly talking about their own beauty and their own weight in negative ways around them. And it starts, you know, that emphasis on their looks starts so young. You know, what is the first thing we say to a little girl? We're like, oh my gosh, look how cute you are. What a pretty dress you're wearing. You know, we'd say that innocently and with good intentions. But then when we see a little boy, we're like, what subject are you, you know, do you love in school? What's your favorite sport? What book are you reading? You know, and so we're telling girls at a very young age that their value and worth is tied to their looks. And when a mom is obsessing about her weight or dieting for years on end, a girl will talk to me about that and say how, you know, she doesn't get it. And she kind of absorbs this narrative that you're supposed to just not like your body ever. And it's really serious because the average age that a girl starts dieting is right now 8 years old. And they also find that eight is the moment, you know, between 8 and 14 is when a girl's confidence drops by 30%. And a boy's confidence doesn't drop like that at that age.
How are you seeing social media impacting girls, and how do you help them approach it?
Yeah, I like to bring something different to the conversation because, of course, everyone is understandably concerned about social media, and there's actually a lot of attention being brought on that. And I like to say, you know, social media is not going anywhere. And I have been one of those people in the actual trenches of hanging out with teenage girls and knowing which accounts they follow and talking about it with them and actually helping them switch up their feed to something that feels good to them and empowering them to make the healthy choices on social media. Instead, what happens is everyone's being like, you should be scared of this. This is awful. This is destroying you. And a girl, again, absorbs that fear. And she doesn't really learn how to trust herself with social media. So I really, again, like to approach it with questions like, what do you think of this post? Do you think this is like an accurate representation of beauty? Do you feel like she did Facetune on this? You know, I engage them that way. I find, you know, the girls really love following accounts that are psychology or mental health oriented. And when you get following a few of those, I mean, girls are sending me cool TikToks on feminism, on really cool topics that they are able to actually have good content also, but that's not an easy thing. I just like to put that out there as a potential because it's really media literacy conversations, which is just a boring way of being like, I talk about with them the TV shows they're watching and the celebrities they like, and I do it in a non-judgmental way where they feel like they can share their interests with me.
Do you have any other advice, I guess, for parents who are trying to strengthen their relationship with their daughter at this time? How can you empower your teen here instead of pushing them away?
Right. The last chapter of the book actually addresses making amends so that you can create a clean slate with your daughter. That was not something I expected to write about. It really just came from a place of the book is filled with many direct quotes from the girls. They were heavily a part of the process and the editing process. And they kept bringing up when I would ask them, what do you wish you could have from your parent? Almost everyone had said they wished that their parent would apologize to them and make amends in some type of way. It could be a big way, you know, like, oh, maybe I'm sorry we didn't handle the divorce very well. Or it could be even a smaller day-to-day owning and taking responsibility, like, oh, whoa, I wasn't right about that. Because teenage girls see through their parents. And when a parent's trying to put on a show as if they have everything handled and perfect and know everything right, a girl knows that's not true because we're all human. And so when you can clear the slate by starting a new foundation of making amends and taking responsibility. And a girl really respects that. And the front side of it, when the girl is younger, setting that foundation of trust, I really like to actually verbalize everything like, hey, you know what? I'm going to trust you to handle that. I believe you can handle that. And I'm excited to see how you handle it. Starting that type of language where she's like, oh, okay. My parent trusts me to handle this. I guess I'll handle it well, you know, like making sure that's really clear.
Chelsea Gooden is a tutor, mentor, public speaker, and the author of Underestimated, The Wisdom and Power of Teenage Girls. It's out now through Gallery Books. You can learn more about Chelsea's work at chelseagooden.com. This year, we did a 4-episode series on endometriosis, an often painful inflammatory disease where tissue similar to the uterine lining grows on organs outside the uterus. It causes symptoms like intense cramping, pain during sex, infertility, and more. It impacts roughly 1 in 10 women. There is no known cause, no definitive cure, and it often takes women years to get a diagnosis. Dr. Karen Tang is a board-certified gynecologist who covered everything from endometriosis to fibroids in her new book out this year called It's Not Hysteria, Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health, But We're Never Told. We've got a whole episode where we touch on things like sexual pain, incontinence, dietary supplements, and PCOS, but here is what she has to share on endometriosis and fibroids.
A lot of these conditions like endo and fibroids run in families. So it is very, very common for the story to be, you know, once you find out, yeah, actually my mom, my grandmother, my aunts, everyone had this issue. They all had super painful periods, heavy bleeding. They had issues with fertility. And it's not until they start to kind of have those conversations that they realize that they share that with so many people in their own family, or that the thought was in their family that horrible periods were just normal because everyone had really terrible periods on a lot of different fronts. Like, we do need to break this taboo and start talking. So my specialty is endometriosis. So I do see a lot of endometriosis, adenomyosis, pelvic pain, but I see the fibroids and PCOS a lot as well. Endometriosis has been a problem historically, because it is somewhat difficult to diagnose it. You have to have a laparoscopic surgery to diagnose it. So in a lot of cases, it probably is just underdiagnosed because not everyone's getting surgery. If they have painful periods or painful sex, they may not necessarily have the surgery that would say that they actually have it. The other things like fibroids, you can get an ultrasound. It's a little bit more cut and dry. Yes, you have fibroids. No, you don't. PCOS people can, you know, check hormones, get an ultrasound, and do some of the testing for PCOS a little bit more simply. And just kind of taking a step back for those listeners who may not know what some of these things are. Endometriosis is super common. It's a common cause of very painful periods and pelvic pain in general. It's a condition where tissue that looks like the tissue that normally comes out like menstrual blood that comes from the cavity of the uterus is called endometrium. Something that looks like that grows outside of the uterus, and it can inflame everything in the pelvis or the abdomen. It can inflame the bowel and cause diarrhea, constipation. It can cause bladder symptoms, infertility issues, because it can scar the tubes or inflame the ovaries. So it can wreak a lot of havoc, and people really suffer for a long time, on average 7 years before they get a diagnosis. So because it is very difficult, a lot of times people have sort of heard through word of mouth, you know, this is an endometriosis specialist. There are different, you know, surgeon lists that are out there for endometriosis specialists. So people kind of make their way because they've heard through the grapevine that, you know, I do specialize in endo.
You know, how is endometriosis different than, say, something like fibroids?
Yeah. So fibroids are actually tumors. They are benign masses, meaning they're non-cancerous masses that grow from the muscle of the uterine wall. So in the example of like a pear, so they would be growing from the wall or the flesh of the pear. Fibroids can grow extremely large. So they can fill like your whole abdomen, and they tend to cause pain and bleeding as well. So they overlap a little bit in the symptoms that they cause, but they are different structures and they're diagnosed differently. So fibroids will show up on imaging studies. If you do an ultrasound and MRI, you're going to see them. And then fibroids can also cause issues with fertility. Sometimes they block the cavity of the uterus and prevent implantation, or they can increase risk of pregnancy loss if they block the cavity. So they can cause kind of like overlapping issues, but they're different things and they're treated differently. Fibroids can be removed surgically. We can cut them out of the uterus, or you could, if someone was done having kids, you could take out the whole uterus and do a hysterectomy. There's a couple of other treatment options that keep the uterus in place. For instance, you can use energy to destroy the fibroids as well, something called the Acessa or the Sonata procedures, where you put a probe into the fibroids and you heat them up and they actually kills the fibroid. And there's procedures that radiologists do where they block the blood flow to the fibroids called uterine fibroid embolization. So there's a whole range of different treatment options. In both scenarios, sometimes people only kind of get like one option. Like with endometriosis, someone might be told, oh, we're only going to give you birth control. Or fibroids, they're like, we only would do a hysterectomy. That's not the case with almost anything in medicine, I would just say. Rarely is it that you have one choice and one choice alone. So this is something I would tell people. If you are being told by your doctor, you only have one option here, I would say get a second opinion, get a third opinion. You know, you deserve to at least know what the different options are. And there may be situations where there's one clear answer that's by far the best, but it's never that you have one choice and that's it. You know, like, they should explain the pluses and minuses of everything.
I know there's no known cause of endometriosis so far, but I guess do we have an idea of where fibroids come from or what contributes to them?
Yeah, so that actually is an interesting point. Fibroids are a condition where we know that there are some environmental factors that can contribute. With everything in women's health, with gynecologic health, we need more data and research. So there is no known, like, this is the one cause, the one gene, the one enzyme that causes all these things, unfortunately. So it's all a little bit mysterious, but there have been associations with fibroid growth and things like vitamin D deficiency. So people who don't have enough vitamin D have a little bit of a higher risk of fibroids. Also things like exposure to phthalates, to endocrine disruptors, environmental exposures, including through things like hair products, like straightening agents, which can include things like phthalates. So some of this is actually thought to be at least a part of the reason that fibroids are more common in Black women, because Black people may be a little bit more likely to be vitamin B deficient. They may use hair straightening products, which can absorb and potentially increase that risk. So again, nobody knows like 100%, but these are like some small factors that we know have some sort of impact that may contribute as well. And then there is almost certainly some sort of genetic component, because they do tend to run in families.
Dr. Karen Tang is a board-certified gynecologist and the author of It's Not Hysteria, Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health, But We're Never Told. You can listen to our full conversation and our four-episode series on endometriosis at our website, wamcpodcasts.org. One of my favorite interviews this year was with the cast and crew of the American Experience documentary Fly With Me, detailing the lives of some of the first flight attendants in the U.S. and how their own fight for better working conditions contributed to the larger feminist movement. In the 1950s and 60s, stewardesses, as they were called back then, were exclusively women, specifically white, young, thin, pretty, and apparently single women. Depending on the company you worked for, you couldn't be married, couldn't really say no to your male passengers, and couldn't be older than age 32. So while it looked like a glamorous gig traveling the world, it also came with a lot of restrictions. Before she became a lawyer and the president of the National Organization for Women in the 1990s, Patricia Ireland was a flight attendant for Pan American Airways. Ireland says it was her early experiences with striking stewardesses that really launched her into the broader women's movement. Before the film's release, I spoke with Ireland and director Helen Dabrowski.
The atmosphere and the service was entirely different than it is these days. We served a hot meal with a cocktail service in advance, then a hot meal on every flight that was over an hour and 15 minutes. I was running up and down the aisles, delivering trays and then picking trays up. And I used to joke and say that it was good training for being in the feminist movement and in Washington, D.C., because part of what I did was pick up people's garbage and thank them for it. So, you know, I decided at some point I wasn't going to take their garbage anymore. And that's when I moved on.
On that note, before we go move forward here, maybe we should talk a little bit about what it was like to be a woman at that time, even in the U.S. You know, you both kind of make it clear in the film that, like, this wasn't really a time where women often traveled alone.
Well, the respectable women didn't travel alone, let's put it that way. Helen, why don't you jump in here? Because I know you did a lot of research and understand what it was like back then.
Well, that, you know, and I think, Patricia, you also do in the film, as you'll see, I don't think you've seen it yet, is we do unpack the expectations for middle class, and I would say predominantly middle class white women in the 1950s. The sort of dominant expectation is you're going to go to school, maybe you'll go to college, then you'll work for a couple of years, and then you will come home, get married, and have children. And the jobs that women of that class were working were typically very gendered jobs, teachers, nurses. This job was something that offered women an opportunity to see the world, or maybe not even see the world, but see more of the United States than they would have in any other female job occupation that you could kind of get those days. While airlines are hiring women who are very much fitting this dominant cultural feminine ideal, they're also hiring women who are curious and capable, and they need to be capable. And they're training them in a lot of different areas: safety, the ability to keep a cool head in an emergency and an evacuated plane, and have all these people management skills. For those who are starting to chafe against the rules and requirements, or the rule that, you know, you have to force retirement at a certain age or fitting a certain bodily standard, the women who start to chafe against those really start to push back, and they're capable and intelligent, and they do that in a number of different ways, as we explore in the film.
And part of what was going on in the external world also spilled over into what we were experiencing with the airlines. At that time, women could not get credit. We didn't have any laws that required equal pay. Abortion was illegal. Birth control was barely available, even for married couples. You couldn't even really go out to dinner in a restaurant by yourself. It was taboo. You were clearly a loose woman. All of those restrictions ended up carrying over to the airlines, where, as Helen said, you had to retire at age 32, or if you got married, the health insurance, medical insurance covered the wives of husbands, but not the husbands of wives, the husbands of flight attendants, because after all, we weren't supposed to have husbands. There was a weight check. They put you on suspension if you were over a certain weight. We had to wear red lipstick and girdles and high heels. I mean, they interested themselves in almost every aspect of our being.
How quickly did I guess this chafe for you, Patricia?
Fairly quickly, although I was one of those women who was late coming to feminism in a way. For one thing, there was in Central and South America, there were a lot of the so-called dirty wars. There was a lot of horrible disappearances and just incredibly oppressive regimes. And I would have one of those generals in the first class and realize I was supposed to be nice to this person. Or I'd be in economy and feel somebody's hand on the back of my leg and realize I was supposed to smile and take it. So that started grating on me sooner rather than later. But then I was there when they changed the rules allowing us to get married. And it was really when my husband needed dental surgery and the airline told me, oh no, if you were a man, we'd cover your wife and family. But because you're a woman, we don't cover your husband. That kind of thing was more immediately distressing because it affected the well-being of my family.
Mm-hmm. You were studying to be a lawyer at this time too, right? You were in law school?
The first 4 years I was not. And then my fifth year, I started law school because I had experienced what was directly illegal job discrimination with the health insurance. I really realized that I had to have more understanding of our rights. The other thing that happened is when the other married flight attendants found out about this change, one of them in the crew room threw her arms around my neck and said, oh, wow, we really won. And that we stuck with me.
I was going to say, you know, when we start looking in sort of the efforts to fight for reform here, what do you feel maybe played the biggest role in your victory on this?
Part of it was affirmative action. President Johnson had just signed an executive order requiring federal contractors to have equal employment laws and non-discrimination laws. So part of it was that the law had already changed a little bit, and it just took someone like me who was bold enough, I guess, to actually take it on and challenge it. So for me, the changes started outside of me and then became part of my very being.
It's not that these women were necessarily waking up in the morning and deciding that they wanted to be activists. It was typically a response to seeing an injustice in the way they were being treated on the job or even trying to get the job and taking any path they could to get there. And the women were doing it in all different ways, some through their unions. I would say that some flight attendants absolutely tried that route and it weren't getting anywhere with it. One flight attendant whose story we follow, she holds a big press conference about how they're getting fired at age 32 and she gets stewardesses together. And can you tell actually when you look at all of us who's over or under 32 and why does that even matter? They'll take it to the press. There's another flight attendant who did the same thing. She brought her story about being fired when she was secretly married to the press. In addition to that, she tried to go through her union, go through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which was in charge of enforcing the Civil Rights Act that said that you cannot have discrimination on the basis of gender. There were women who filed lawsuits. I would say that these individuals are sort of taking any way, any method, any path they can in order to get their job, keep their job, or make it more equitable.
One part of the documentary that I thought was really interesting was just like, you know, how you had to even fight to get the Equal Opportunity Commission to do its job and to take, you know, women's complaints seriously. And I can't remember who said it in the documentary, so I'm sorry, but there was someone who mentioned that, you know, like if there's a law that people don't want to enforce, they might just not do it.
That's Patricia. <Sorry. laughs>
You had a good quote.
Well, the other thing that was interesting to me, because now we've come up to the point where the National Organization for Women had been formed in 1966, and a woman named Sonia Fuentes, who was one of the founders, was the first woman lawyer in the general counsel's office at the EEOC. And she was horrified by what she found, that is the unwillingness to enforce the law on behalf of women. And so she and a couple of her friends, including a man named Phineas Idris, I loved his name, and Mary Eastwood. And after work, she would go over there to Mary's apartment and they would talk about what was going on and they would strategize about how to change it. And the next month, the EEOC would find itself with a whole lot of women picketing their offices for failure to enforce the law on behalf of women. And they could never quite figure out how Now knew about this stuff. Sonia said she had a lot of mixed emotions about it because she's a very honest and a woman of great integrity. But she decided that the principle of equality overrode her employer's desire for her to keep things confidential. That law being passed and the EEOC, many of them for good reason, because the law in their view was aimed at racial discrimination and prejudice. And because there wasn't sufficient funding, and today there's even less funding, there was a resource allocation issue. And that to me was why we ended up with this trio. That is a woman who was willing to step forward and take the risk, a law that said she was entitled to what she was seeking, and an outside organization to push hard on public opinion. And that, I think, is the combination. Plus, we had some good people elected to office, but I always thought they were kind of a last step. We had to change their constituencies' minds first.
Hmm. How do you feel this either folded into or contributed to the overall women's movement?
Yeah, it was definitely part of what was going on throughout the country and throughout the various places that women were. I think that part of what happened is that the flight attendants, because the rules and regulations were so tied to the gender expectations of women, probably saw and rankled against these restrictions very early. But also, I think that there was a certain prejudice within the feminist movement against women who used their looks to get ahead. And that was certainly part of getting to be a stewardess, as we were then known. You had to look the way that the men in the company wanted you to look, you know, just generally act the way a traditional woman was supposed to, which is, by the way, how the Southwest Airlines union, the transport workers union, got in there, because Southwest Air tried to put their flight attendants in orange shorts, little tiny shorts. And the women went to the company's head and said, "We're not going to wear these little shorts." And he said, "Well, what you women need," I think what he said was, "what you girls need is a union," never thinking they would do that. But, you know, the process of the feminist movement and the women who were stewardesses getting together was not always without its friction.
When you look back on that time, you know, is there a particular moment that you find yourself going back to a lot or that particularly sticks in your mind?
Gosh, that's a good question. And I found that my coworkers, my colleagues, were just the best group of people. And it's why when I was practicing law in recent years, after I came back from Now, I went in to represent unions and their members, because I found flight attendants to be among the funniest, best people. They were smart. They were experienced in the world. They were well-read. They just were a wonderful group of women and then men, because that was also a problem as getting men into the flight attendant job in later years. But I miss my friends. I liked everything about my colleagues. They were great.
Patricia Ireland is a former president of the National Organization for Women and one of the many former flight attendants featured on the New American Experience documentary Fly With Me, directed by Helen Dabrowski and Sarah Colt. You can watch the film on PBS's website, pbs.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Again, to hear any of today's conversations in full, check us out at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Have a happy new year. And until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.